The late Teddy King, accompanied by pianist Marion McPartland, and we begin a new series of Marion McPartland piano jazz programs Monday afternoon at 4 o'clock. It's 23 minutes after 4. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY 91 FM. And with me now on Fresh Air is actress Nancy Marchand, who will be appearing next week in a Philadelphia Drama Guild production of Oliver, Oliver. Nancy Marchand is best known to television audiences as Mrs. Pynchon, the aristocratic newspaper publisher on The Lou Grant Show. She received 4 Emmys for her work on that show. She's also appeared in many TV movies and in the feature film The Bostonians, which opens today at the Eric Rittenhouse and the Budco Bryn Mawr Theaters. But most of Nancy Marchand's professional life has been in theater. She recently starred in the Broadway revival of Mornings at 7, for which she received the Drama Desk Award and the Outer Critics Circle Award. She also performed in the recent Circle in the Square production of Clifford Odette's Awake and Sing. Her other Broadway shows include Miss Reardon Drinks a Little, 40 Carats, and Much Ado About Nothing. Off-Broadway, she's performed in Sister Mary Ignatius Explains It All for You, and in 1960, she performed in the first New York production of Jean Genet's The Balcony. The Philadelphia Drama Guild production of Oliver opens Friday, October 5th, at the Annenberg Center, and runs through October 28th. For more information, you can call 563-PLAY, that's 563-PLAY. Nancy Marchand, it's a great treat to meet you. Welcome to Fresh Air. Do you read all your scripts for movies, TV, theater before deciding to take on a role? You read it all yourself?
Generally, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What interested you in Oliver, Oliver? What excites you about that?
Well, I did Oliver, Oliver in 1955, and I played the same role I'm playing now. I was certainly not suited for it then, but I hope I'm better suited for it now, because the lady I play is the age I am now. It is a beautifully crafted play. It is extremely funny. And it is, I think, in a way, very unique because it is a high-style comedy that really includes the audience as one of the people in the play.
And the play is Oliver, Oliver, and it will open at the Annenberg Center with the Drama Guild next week. What did you like about the script for the Lou Grant series when you first saw that?
Now, that is something I did not read.
Really?
No. I was asked if I would like to work 6 to 8 days a month in California with Ed, and I had known Ed for a long time. And when you do a series like that, or when you're invited to be interested, you have to look at it as an investment. You have no idea how long it's going to run, you know. Sure, I'd love to try it. Maybe it'll run through January. If it goes longer, well, then we'll make that adjustment when we get to that bridge.
What kind of character background did you get on the Margaret Pynchon character when the series was about
to start? Oh, they were terrific. They were always terrific on that show. I was given reams and reams of material about publishing in general, biographical material on Mrs. Hobby, Dolly Schiff, Catherine Graham, of course, and several other lady publishers. There were a lot of women publishers in this country, and how they became involved. None of them started out as publishers, of course. Most of them took over after their husbands had died, which was the situation that I had. And they were always wonderful about it. If you had asked a question, you know, they would. They had a research department that was terrific.
Had you seen the Lou Grant character on the Mary Tyler Moore Show before doing the Lou Grant Show?
Had I seen the Lou Grant character? You mean
did you
had
used
I
to
seen
watch the,
did, Ed play Lou then?
Yeah, on the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Yes, I wasn't a regular watcher, but I had seen him do it.
Did you have any opinions on how the character changed from the Mary Tyler Moore Show to the Lou Grant Show?
Well, Lou Grant started out to be have more comedy in it than it did. And that was when Jim Brooks was working with the production team. Then Jim went off on other projects, and Gene Reynolds really took over, and he was more interested in the, you know, the factual kind of thing.
Were there any themes that you...
Although Gene has a fabulous, antique sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Were there any themes, sexual or political, that you weren't supposed to touch on the program or that you got in trouble for touching?
Well, Terry, I think we were constantly getting in trouble. Yeah, I know we were.
Which shows or which issues got you in the most trouble?
Well, I don't know, because I was just an actor and I used to fly in from New York to do the show and then fly out again. But I do know we had problems with dumping products that the Department of Agriculture did not allow to be sold in this country, dumping them in third world countries. We had problems with condominium developments going into apartment houses where people with fixed incomes were living and sweeping them out. We also had problems with old folks' homes, a story we had about that. And, of course, then our bête noire was the Burn Center show with for the atomic scare. That really was what did us in.
There was a lot of speculation that the reason why the show went off the air was because of the themes that the show took on and also because of Ed Asner's liberal politics. The network kept saying, no, it's the ratings. What do you think?
I don't know that much about ratings. I do know that the things I just mentioned, plus many more, were beginning to get the network down. And I do know that Ed's outspokenness became an irritant. I do know that. I also know that there were special interest groups that had, with great deliberation, got people to write to certain sponsors saying, if you continue sponsoring this show, we will not buy your products. And I must say, there have been lots of people who have said to me years before when I was doing soaps, we don't like the way this soap is going. We don't like the way, why don't they do this? Why don't? And I used to say, just watch to see who's being advertised on the soap and write to them and tell them that you're not going to watch if they don't do something about it. So it is the most powerful weapon, if you want to call it that. Really and truly, the people have the voice, and they used it.
So it's funny. It's a tool that you'd always recommended people using suddenly being
used against
you. To improve
something or... Yeah. Well, that can always happen.
You played the Margaret Pinchon character for how long? How long was the series on?
5 years.
Does the character really get under your skin after that long? I mean, does she really become a part of you after 5 years of playing it?
Oh, I don't think so. No. I think maybe it's the other way around. They begin using elements of me that they can, they might find funny, or they might say, you know, she really seems to feel very strongly about such and such. Why don't we give her a problem where she can do that? And I think it gets more that way, goes the other way.
Did you ever use her to get you out of a situation in which you thought her personality would be more appropriate to solve the problem than yours?
Well, that's why I think I'm saying I think probably there was a lot of Margaret Pinchon that was my personality. And I had used that to get me out of situations, yeah.
My guest is Nancy Marchand, and she's about to open in the Drama Guild production of Oliver, Oliver, which will be at the Annenberg Center in West Philadelphia. Now, you're currently in the Bostonians, and the Bostonians opens today in Philadelphia.
Right.
For the movie The Bostonians, did you read the Henry James novel before?
Yes, I did.
Did that tell you something that the script didn't? about your character?
Yes. Because, of course, the Henry James novel is several hundred pages. And certain scenes were much clearer and much longer and more detailed. And, of course, Henry James was not very big on dialogue. Henry James is big on atmosphere, ambiance, and so there were a lot of descriptive things about the lady that necessarily are not in the movie, you know, are not in the show. So that helped me a great deal. I love the book. It's a wonderful book. Very interesting social aspect from somebody like Henry James, who was an effete Yankee who spent most of his life in Europe. Coming back here and rediscovering his country and finding a very unpleasant element about us as people.
Do you ever get impatient when you're making a movie after being on the stage for so long where you actually do, you go through a role from the beginning to the end, everything's in sequence, it's in real time, as opposed to a movie which is hurry up and wait and you do maybe a minute scene up for 2 hours?
Not if you read the script through and you study it well and you know where you fit in. And I did do a picture many years ago where we rehearsed for 4 weeks and we had run-throughs. And the picture was made in a very short time. I think it was a pretty good picture. It was called The Bachelor Party. And it was one of Patty Chayefsky's pictures. But I think we made that in record time, something like 16 days, as opposed to 6 weeks. But we spent the time rehearsing and preparing, you know.
I had this nightmare the other night that, I'm not an actress, right? Yeah. But I had this nightmare that I had to go on for somebody else. And the curtain was going to go up at 8, and at 4 o'clock I was handed this huge script, and they said, you've got to memorize it. You've got 4 hours. And I said, oh, how am I going to remember? How am I? And I just didn't know where to start. Now, you have obviously more time than that when you have a script, but how do you learn a script?
Not always don't have that much time, more time, no.
Well, where do you start? How do you do it?
If you do a sitcom, mm-hmm. You go and you read it, and you might block it out. And then the writers come and look at it, and they say, well, it's not funny. And so everybody goes home, and then an hour later, there's a knock on the door, and you're handed a completely different script. So it's part of my skill or craft, I guess it is. I guess you'd call it part of my craft to learn quickly. To learn something like Oliver, a play that I know I'm going to be working on for several weeks before we perform. I always learn my lines before I start rehearsal. And I always learn them in terms of the structure of where the scene comes into the act, whose scene it is, what my job is in the scene, if I'm supporting somebody, or if a scene belongs to me, how it moves the play ahead. And in terms of what the other person says to me, what is going on, in terms of how my character is developing, what I say is something I had to say at that moment, and I have to figure out why. Once I get that worked out, learning the lines is a cinch. Hmm.
Do you ever have acting nightmares?
No.
Then how come I have
them? I did years ago, I did a one-act play that was taking place on a chessboard, and we were all people, but, you know, it was one of those symbolic numbers, and you had to jump from one square on the stage to the next, depending on how your situation was in terms of the other people. And I did, for a while after doing that play, dream about being in that play and jumping right off the stage into the audience. But that's really the only bad acting nightmare I've ever had. Did you ever see Sister Mary Ignatius with the curtain raiser called An Actor's Nightmare?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's a very funny play.
Well, Sister Mary Ignatius now, which you performed in Off-Broadway, it's been touring the country, and it seems that every city it goes to, there's pickets and there's people who are trying to close it down.
Right.
Do you understand what it is in the play that's causing that kind of strong emotional fear of it?
For one thing, this country is at this time is very religious conscious. It appears to be a very anti-Catholic play. I don't think that's really what it's about. But, you know, when an audience comes to the theater, they usually watch the plot or follow the play in terms of its story, mm-hmm. and not start working on what is this play really about. It is very anti-Catholic. Yeah.
Did that bother you?
That's why people just, you know, get disturbed by it. No, what I was attracted to that play for was what I think I saw in the play I think what Chris is trying to say is mindless authority can be very destructive. And our country is becoming more and more filled with mindless authority. And it's scary, and it produces very dangerous people.
Have you ever tried to rewrite lines of dialogue, either in television or on the stage, if you felt that it didn't ring true for the character that you were portraying?
No, not for a play that has been produced before. If I'm doing a revival. I mean, that's the line, and you've got to learn how to say it right. For new things, sure. The Lou Grant people were terrific, marvelous.
What's the etiquette of that? Who do you have to ask permission from before you can actually change the line?
Well, I would always call the producer, who was also a writer, one of the writers, and he, as a matter of fact, did write some of the shows. And usually they used to meet, the story editor, the producer, and the writers of a particular script used to meet like mid-morning till mid-afternoon. So I always knew that they were there, and I would call them. Or if I was in town, if I was in Los Angeles, or even if I had a scene coming up the next day and I had a little time off the day before, I would go in and ask them or call them on the phone, you know, and explain to them why it seemed strange to me or could we put this in instead. And sometimes it would right away they'd say sure. Sometimes, well, we'll think about it and let you know. We did have a dialogue director, and they were very strict about that. You couldn't fiddle around with the lines when you were shooting. You had to say what was written, you know, for which I was grateful, because you can get an awful lot of mushy gook with this, improvisatory attitude.
Where have you worked where there was more of an emphasis on improvisation?
Improvisations are improvisations, but when you're doing work, you should know how to achieve your moment by using the material it's given you, you know.
Who are some of the contemporary playwrights that you think write the best dialogue in their plays?
Well, I just saw this Ma Rainey thing over at the Annenberg Center, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I think he's very skillful writer. And have you seen a play called Danny in the Deep Blue Sea? I don't even know his name. Very skilled writer. It is playing in New York now. I thought maybe it might be playing in other places too. I think Paul Osborne is a genius. I mean, he has such an ear for people's the way they express themselves in terms of how where they come from. You mentioned Mornings at 7, which took place in, maybe Michigan or, you know. And their attitudes and the way they talk and the way they treat each other and the way they address each other is so different from his play that we're doing now. The play, it takes place in Connecticut in the hot summer, and everybody's so sophisticated and nobody dares really say what they mean for fear, God forbid, anybody should laugh at them for being honest or earnest or, you know, totally different rhythms, different syntax, and comparing it with those sweet little kind of country folk, you know. I just think he's wonderful.
It means you've had to take on very different personalities from both those plays, mm-hmm. and different speech patterns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you do research for the roles?
No. I'm getting awful old to do things like that, unless it's something that's not just about people. But I grew up in the 30s and remembered, I didn't grow up in this kind of a society, the filthy rich, but Vogue magazines and Vanity Fair magazines and an awful lot of movies in the 30s dealt with these kind of people. Cary Grant and, you know, that sophisticated high society kind of marvelous wit and, you know, that kind of thing. So, there's still a kind of segment of society that's around now. Charlotte Curtis writing in the Times. That's about the background I used, yeah.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Buffalo.
Buffalo, New York?
Yes, I'm a Buffalo girl. Can't you tell?
Actually, I should be able to. I lived there for about 8 years myself.
In Buffalo?
Yeah.
Really? Where?
Near the campus and then all over. I lived in about 7 different places in the 8 years I lived there.
Did you go to school there?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I lived not too far from the school, from UB.
When did you know you wanted to be an actress?
Oh, and they're funny. People always ask me that. I don't think it was a decision. My mother speaks of when I was, even before I spoke well, like, you know, between, I was 18 months old. They would drive in the country and I would sit in the back seat by myself and carry on conversations in different voices with different people. And she said, none of the conversation, I mean, there were no words that you could understand, but it was understanding to me. I understood it. And in my childhood, my youth, in my neighborhood, my little buddies, we always did plays. That's what we did. We didn't play dolls or, I suppose we roller skated and did things like that. But most of our activity was producing plays and performing them and rehearsing them. I don't think we really ever did them anywhere. It was not some organized thing, but that's, I always did it.
Did you go to New York to make it on Broadway?
I was sent to a theater school when I was 10 years old because I was so socially inept. And the lady that ran the school...
Wait, you were sent to theater school because you were socially inept? Not because you wanted to act?
No, my mother thought that I was always out to lunch, you see. I was always doing some play in my head. And I came from a kind of family where... when someone walked in the room, you were to get up. You never went downtown without white gloves on, and I just was out to lunch. So she thought, oh, well, maybe I could just give her a little sacle there, you know, and send her to acting school and make her feel a little less self-conscious. And the lady who ran the school suggested I go to Carnegie Tech. And... then I came to New York, or I went to New York when I finished at Tech.
Did theater school, in fact, change your social interactions?
Well, it was a wonderful, it really and truly was a wonderful discovery for me. Of course, I had gone to movies, lots of movies when I was a kid. But the idea of a stage and being able to be another person, that I could do it, I could do, and I realized it was what I'd been doing all along. Well, that was wonderful. I mean, it gave me a feeling that, okay, I was going to make it. I was safe. I was going to be okay. So, yes, I think so.
What was the first big break that you had in your career?
Let me see. I think, you mean in New York as a
mm-hmm.
professional?
Yeah.
I think it was a two-parter on a show called Studio One, and they were just starting Studio One, but I think they had done one season, and this was around the Christmas season that I got this part. I played Joe in Little Women. And it was a two-parter. It was 2 weeks in a row. And it was the big lead.
You know, that reminds me that you also played the girlfriend in Marty on TV.
Right? Oh, yes. Oh, but I was an old vet by then.
But that show had so much emotional resonance with the people who watched it. Can you, do you have any idea, like, what it was about it that...
Well, I think a lot of them did. In those days, because there was nothing. How should I say this? You had the play, and you had the actors. You didn't have any production values to speak of, so you had to go out there and do it. And there weren't directors who were giving clever shots, and there wasn't lots of fancy composers writing super duper music that was going to fill in the empty holes. You didn't have color. You had to really do the thing. And I think television, a lot of it had more emotional impact.
Am I right in saying that you've chosen to spend a good deal of your career on stage as opposed to, say, in the movies? What attracts you to theater acting? You know, because a lot of actors, given the choice, would drop theater just to be in movies or TV instead. It's obviously not a choice you've made.
Well, I was trained for it. I love it. I love performing with people. I mean, with the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I adore that. I love doing it. And I like making films. And I've done tons of television. It's just that I'm married, and we had children. And... as far as we were concerned, New York was the place to raise children. And if you wanted to be in films, you had to move out there. And we were very lucky. We constantly had work. It didn't always pay a lot of money, but we always worked. So, I mean, in this business, don't always throw something like that out the window to go 3,000 miles for maybe we'll see, you know.
Your husband, Paul Spearer, is also an actor.
Mm-hmm.
Did you, once you had children, decide that you would do something as formal as alternating who worked so that one person could be home while the other person
that.
Was working?
Yes, we did do that. We did that for 9 years until we realized that we were so poor we couldn't go on any longer and it had to stop. So that's when we got a full-time lady.
Were there periods ever, if you don't mind my asking, of resentment in the marriage because, you know, maybe a perfect role was coming along that you'd have to turn down because it was your spouse's turn?
No.
You know?
No,
I don't know how formal the alternation was.
No. I do think that there were maybe more from my husband's point of view than mine, that there were times that he did not take things because whatever I was doing was something nice, but I was making 27 cents a week. And so he would turn something down because he was making for the bread and butter. Yeah.
You must be like bi-coastal now, right? Since you've done
I was, which is also on the West Coast, but I'm not anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, I haven't gone out. I did go out the week before I came here, and I did a little zippy thing. But I was bi-coastal, totally. Yeah. And when I was doing mornings at 7 and that, I was just crazy.
A lot of people know your face because you've been, as you say, on a lot of television shows and movies and on stage.
Yeah.
And you've been in so many different roles that it's not like you're just one person. You know, you're not just associated with one character. How have you arranged your life so as to not have to be too inhibited by the fact that if you walk around your home in Manhattan, people are going to recognize you? I mean, does
they do all the time.
Recognized?
Well, you know, I worked a lot at Lincoln Center, and I live on the West Side, and so I often there used to be people in the supermarket or at the laundry or, you know, say, "Oh, we saw you playing in John Loves Mary down at the Lincoln Center, and we didn't like it as well as when we saw you do such and such," and little by little, you begin to recognize those people who recognize you, and it's like in the neighborhood, you know. And once in a while, it can be terrific. I just this last spring, I was tearing. I was so late, and I was rushing, and it was so important, and I had to get downtown for an express subway, and just as I got there, they were closing the doors, and I happened to be at the front end of the train. And as I ran down, the conductor saw me. He says, "Oh, Mrs. Pynchon, okay, don't worry, don't worry." And he pushed the button and told the guy to open the door, and in I got. Now you say, "Oh, now you see, it does pay off." But then sometimes there are people who pick and pick at you, and, "Can I take your picture? And can you we stand with my sister?" So I can, and that gets to be a little disturbing.
You always feel like you have to be looking your best in case you notice.
Yes, but I have what I think is a very funny story. You know, it's hard sometimes not to sound like you think you're the Queen of Sheba, and yet at the same time not be rude to people. And I was in Mornings at 7, and I had just come back from New York, and I had won my second Emmy, and I was walking on Broadway, and I was on my way down to get some fish at the fish store, and I had so many people stopping and saying, "Congratulations," and it was, we thought that was terrific, or we liked your speech or something, and I just, "Thank you, thank you, thank you," and I was on my way back from the fish store, and there was a black man coming toward me. And I could see in his face he was going to speak to me. And so I found myself preparing my body and everything to say, "Thank you very much." And he came up to me and he bent over and he whispered in my ear, "Excuse me, lady, your fly is open." Well, I started to laugh. And, of course, my reaction so shocked him that he didn't know what to do, and I threw my arms around him, and I said, "Thank you so much." And then I proceeded to zip up my fly, and I went on home. But I just, I mean, it's hard, you know, to know when to be gracious and when to not get filled up with so much of that.
Yeah. Well, I regret we're almost out of time. The time has just flown. Can you tell us a little more about Oliver Oliver, which you're opening in next week?
Oh, yes. Oliver Oliver is playing where the Drama Guild, the Philadelphia Drama Guild, and we're playing at the Zellerbach Theater. We're opening, I think,
next Friday. Maybe a little bit about the story.
It is a delicious comedy, which I guess you could say it's a wise child that knows its own parent. And it's also a wise child that knows itself. It's terribly funny. It's delicious. And I love every minute of it. It's very chic and a wonderful evening in the theater. It's directed by the same man that directed Mornings at 7. So you can't miss.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been interesting. Thanks a lot for being
here. Oh, Terry,
it
was fun. Thank you.
Nancy Marchand has been my guest, and she opens in the play Oliver, Oliver next Friday, October 5th. It will run through October 28th. It's a Drama Guild production, and it will be shown at the Annenberg Center, performed at the Annenberg Center. For more information, you can call 563-PLAY. That's 563-PLAY. And again, Oliver, Oliver opens next Friday, October 5th, and runs through October 28th. Well, I'll tell you what's happening Monday afternoon on Fresh Air after we check in with Shadow Traffic and Nancy Marchand. Thank you again.
Good to be here.
Of course, extreme caution heading home this afternoon because of scattered rain, drizzle, and the wet roadways. Some flooding conditions in the low-lying areas. If you're heading home westbound on the Schuylkill Expressway, a 15-minute delay from west of Passyunk down through Gray's Ferry because of an earlier accident cleared at South Street. Just a minor delay at the crossover. Northbound I-95 is running slow as you approach Wraith Street through Aramingo, a 10- to 15-minute delay. 5 minutes through the Betsy Ross Bridge construction. Traffic backing down once again as you approach Academy Road through the Grand Avenue construction. For a motorist in Lower Marion, Ardmore, we have a four-car accident in the process of being cleared at Airedale Road near Montgomery Avenue. And keep in mind, though, the Tacony-Palmyra Bridge scheduled for an opening at about 7 o'clock tonight for the tugboat, the Diplomat. That's Shadow Traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is Chris Knight.
This is WHYY FM, Philadelphia.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lynn Neary with All Things Considered.
Christian, but I still think state and religion should be separate.
Well, I think if we don't have religious leaders in our government, well, it's just the downfall of our country.
Church and state and how separate they should be. Tonight on All Things Considered, how this issue has become a central theme in this year's presidential campaign.
Also these stories. Congress is making haste to adjourn so congresspeople can return home to campaign, but first there's business to finish up here in Washington.
President Reagan and the Soviet foreign minister Andrei Gromyko meet over lunch at the White House.
A listen to the latest album by Ricky Lee Jones.
And former football star Jim Brown talks about his record for career rushing, which is about to be broken. First news.
This is Brian Naylor. President Reagan met at the White House today with Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko for 4 hours. It's the first in-depth meeting the president has had with a Soviet leader in his nearly 4 years in office. Emerging from the meeting, Gromyko clasped his hands over his head, and Secretary of State Shultz characterized the dialogue as strong, forceful, and direct. NPR's Jim Engel has details from the White House.
Secretary of State George Shultz characterized the meeting as a useful and intense exchange, largely between President Reagan and Mr. Gromyko, with advisers talking very little. The Secretary of State said they did not deal with many specifics, but rather with what he called the overriding questions: how to reduce the two nations' nuclear arsenals, and where the relationship between the U.S. and the Soviet Union should go. The President and White House officials had been saying that they hoped the meeting would offer a chance to resume a dialogue between the two nations and clear the air a bit. Secretary Shultz was asked if today's meeting had accomplished that.
There's lots of distrust, there's lots of apprehension, there are lots of differences of opinion, and I don't think one discussion is going to clear the air completely, but I think it undoubtedly made some progress in that direction.
When asked what specifically the meeting had accomplished, Secretary Shultz said that at the end, as Gromyko was leaving, the president said the U.S. agreed to stay in touch. Later today, it was announced that Shultz and Gromyko will meet one more time before Gromyko leaves tomorrow morning at the State Department. I'm Jim Engel at the White House.
One suspect has been arrested in connection with an attack early today on the U.S. Embassy in Lima, Peru.
Three to...